This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, it's a real pleasure to have with me right here in the studio the folk singer Dar Williams, whose latest album is My Better Self. Dar Williams, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
This album seems real political, more so than some of your others, though you have political songs on those too. But do you have a heightened sense of urgency right now?
That's right on. Yes, I have a heightened sense of urgency. It's a temperature reading for what's going on right now, and for better or for worse. I mean, there's some personal songs there that you know, give the context of how one's personal life can be very forward moving and growing, and that can happen in the context of a society that's going to pot. and then there's things like remembering what it was like to be a teenager, being a religious teenager, which I kind of stuck into the context of a teenager at a Christian camp that actually, again, in the sort of temperature reading of the present, sort of points to the sort of adolescent nature of some of the religious fanatics in our government. And so, you know, everything seems to sort of point to sussing out the politics that sort of came to my doorstep, not to mention, you know, some of the more overt things, such as the song called Empire.
That one song you were talking about is called Teen for God.
Right.
And it's about these fundamentalist teenagers who say they're never going to have sex.
They're not going to smoke pot, they're not going to drink, and they like to swap stories about all those terrible things that happen to people who do drink and get, you know, drunk and have sex and all that stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of scare tactics in that adolescent devotion. and maybe it belongs there. I mean, it's a very purist time as a teenager, but when you find you know, people in our society who can't temper that kind of passion with some wisdom about the human condition and the aging process and not being so judgmental, you know, then you sort of have an immature culture. So it was an interesting contrast between my religious fervor as a teenager and how I feel now, which is that I kind of miss some of the fervor, and at the same time, I feel more adult as I go forward.
I read that you at one point were an atheist, and then you became a believer in God. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, that is true, actually. I was, well, you know, for so many years I was trying to believe in God. And when I was a teenager and then in college, I was a Buddhist, and I was always trying to tap into sort of this divine energy. And, you know, it works sometimes. I mean, I've had that experience in meditation, and I've had that experience in the Quaker church, you know, that's called the ecstatic state. And I reached the ecstatic state, and that was turned out to be different from waking up one morning after my cousin had died, actually, and believing in God. And I have believed, you know, every once in a while I check in and I say, do I still believe in God? And the answer is absolutely yes. And it's I thought, oh gosh, okay, well, I believe in God. I guess I should go to church now. And I went to a couple of churches and I thought, no, that's the weird thing. You know, after going to so many churches in my life and trying to go with the flow with so many denominations, Eastern, Western, I don't really feel a need to go to church at all. And in fact, I feel like it would sort of pent up, it would sort of overly structure the sort of free-form belief that I have and the relationship that I feel that I do have now.
Which is a very personal one compared to the structured one you're talking about. What do you make of the heightened influence of the right-wing fundamentalists in this country?
Well, again, I just think it's really immature. And it's also rife with double standards. I mean, you have someone like Rick Santorum, who is incredibly ambitious and very overbearing, and it just doesn't seem, you know, it doesn't jive with my spiritual experiences, my experiences of believing in God. I mean, I feel like believing in God has allowed me to sort of sit back and be more tolerant. And, you know, I actually think that the religious right is facing what the idealistic left had to face, which is that just because you kind of get out the vote and exert your influence doesn't mean that your politician's going to come through for you. And I think that they really thought that by coming out en masse and voting for Bush, they were going to start to see some of the more sort of strict orthodoxies enforced, and that didn't happen. And they got to face the same disillusionment as the idealistic left, and we'll see if there's a voting impact from not getting their radical agenda passed, because I do think it has been hindered somewhat by the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Though they seem to have blackmailed Bush on the Supreme Court choice of Harriet Myers to get rid of her.
They are trying, yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. And I'm sure that it must not be fun to actually alienate the Christian right, but I see George Bush hedging away from the whole choice issue that they, you know, have made paramount.
You talked a little bit earlier, Dar Williams, about just kind of taking the temperature of the culture of our society right now. What is the reading? I mean, are we at 105?
I would say the thing that scares me the most is the idea that we might be finding ourselves sort of rushing towards either, you know, the democratic mechanisms or the environmental mechanisms that can really save us as a planet or as a culture, and they won't be there anymore. And, you know, after Katrina, when Rita came along and they said, if Rita knocks out more refineries, we might have $5 per gallon gas, I thought, oh no, there's going to be a stampede for all of the stuff that we've been sort of talking about at dinner parties, biodiesel and solar and wind and, you know, but people are going to bottleneck towards it so quickly that it's just going to be a mess. And the wrong people will take advantage of the panic as they always do. And similarly, I believe that, you know, in terms of our democracy, I mean, we're sort of shrugging our shoulders and saying, oh dear, Guantanamo, that's so awful, that's so awful. But it's good. It arrives at your doorstep sooner or later. And I heard one interview with a person saying that he was afraid that while the pendulum swings from the left to the right and the left to the right, that there are so many people in place right now who have taken the pendulum and just pinned it to the right that there is a fear that it's never going to swing back.
I know I have that fear.
No matter who's indicted, yeah.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. It's Matt Rothschild, your host, and I'm speaking with Dar Williams. You mentioned Katrina, and on this latest album of yours, which must have been done before Katrina, My Better Self, you have a song called The Blue Light of Flame, where you...
It's actually Two Sides of the River that came out of New Orleans.
Really?
The Blue Light of the Flame, it actually could apply in a funny way, but it's a song I wrote for my friend Rachel Bissix. That also speaks to the fact that we sort of immerse ourselves in these apocalyptic panics, and then there are some people who just kind of sit quietly close to death, and which is what she was, mm-hmm. you know, sort of tapping into their own sort of wisdoms. Two Sides of the River talks about the sort of precariousness of love, you know, and life, you know, the two sides of the river. You have to watch the tides and hope that they don't shift while you're asleep and, you know, pull you out of your life, your marriage, your relationship, you know, as certain tides will do. And so the river is a metaphor for desire and, you know, the human condition that sort of pulls us out of the vows and the actions that we meant to keep. And it's funny because New Orleans has a lot of that precariousness that came from being there a couple of years ago from a culture that knows that it was under sea level and that knows that a lot of its wealth comes out of poverty, you know, has this tragicomic, paradoxical awareness of how fragile things are. You know, rice and beans and jazz and blues, those are all the riches that come out of poverty. And you felt that, you know. I felt that when I was down there. All of the contradictions that made it so rich. And I think when Katrina came along, that was part of the sort of awareness. You know, another paradox would be if somehow this is a country that could allow such a cultural gem as New Orleans to go underwater because we won't pay $70 million to fix the levees. You know, there is this kind of the rich white guy isn't going to come through for us, and we're going to have to swim in his toxic stew for the next 5 years. And that is very much that kind of the culture that grows out of that kind of awareness that people don't come through, and some things just are awful, and they don't get better, and justice does not get served.
I remember speaking to a poet from New Orleans who, when I asked him about Katrina and the image of those people on that patch of highway just sitting in the sun for 3 days in a row, and I asked him, how did he interpret that as someone from there? He said, they wanted us to die. It was such a dramatic thing. But you've been talking about environmental issues for a long time, way before, you know, these hurricanes hit and everyone started talking about global warming. Mm-hmm. How'd you get interested in environmentalism?
I took a class called The Human Prospect in college. You know, it's great. It was a professor. He's since died, and I'm just so grateful because he really had us steeped in, you know, an awareness that is complex. You know, and it's funny. I sit and write little lists to myself. You know, what's going to solve the energy problem? And I there's renewable energy, and then there's lowering the population. And you know, he had us thinking in all sorts. And what lowers the population is lowered infant mortality, because you know there's some real complex factors that lower population. And he really kind of tuned us into looking at all sorts of facets around an environmental awareness. He said, you know, buy yourself an expensive chair made by an artisan instead of 16 chairs made by Target or whoever, you know. And it was that kind of – I was living with a woman after that class, a friend of mine, and I would leave a room and come back and the light would be turned off, you know. And I was like, who's acting like me? And I thought, oh, this is my friend from the class.
And you still do that. I read you are cognizant of what happens to the bottles of water, that your plastic bottles of water you're drinking on stage.
Right. No, I've been – that was a thing that I was turned on to recently, this whole sort of question, because there is no public water policy that's keeping, you know, bottled water companies from going in and taking the water out of the aquifers people need. If and when we get to a problem where there's a drought or there's, you know, permanent aquifer problems, water table problems, you know, there won't be any clear lines as to who has the rights to that water first, the water companies or the people. And so I have to confess that we came into a few cities where the water quality was just such that I preferred bottled water. And then it all kind of just went to hell because I just have a lot on my plate. So I'm going to try to offset my waste in some other way, a la Bill Clinton.
Well, even you, Darwin's, can't do everything.
So. No, I'm really, really aware of that.
Tell me about the song Empire, which is on My Better Self. You talk about some of the things that I think are crucial for us to understand about this country, but why don't you go?
I think the best, most solid place to stand as you look at your present situation is on a foundation of history, especially history that echoes and echoes. And the Roman Empire, the British Empire, and frankly the fascist empire have things in common, which are that as they built outward, they lost the center. And one can argue in purely pragmatic terms, they lost their financial center. But they certainly also, I think, lost their they had to apply harsh, more and more harsh rhetoric of superiority and sort of divine right to justify the building of hegemony, you know.
And here's a word that's on the album. You don't find that on a lot of albums either.
You rhyme that
with enemy, hegemony.
Well, and now I love that word because it's a very poetic word. It hegemony is not defined by rivers or conventional borders. It's dominance, it's influence. And so we get to decide in our hearts, you know, are we in Iraq to help restore something? Or are we there to establish dominance? And I think it's a cautionary song because empires are doomed. You know, you just become more diffuse. You become broke. You become demagogues. You know, demagogues rule. And I was just pointing out some maybe similarities between past empires and what's going on right now. Like, how can you torture people and say, well, that's just a few bad apples in our culture, but have 17 terrorists take down the World Trade Center and say, okay, we're going to go to war with entire countries, which is really what we're doing. Because when you visit war upon a country, you're visiting upon the whole country.
We recently passed this ghoulish landmark in the United States of 2,000 U.S. soldiers killed, and in Iraq there may be more than 100,000 civilians killed. What was your reaction when we passed that landmark?
I well, it felt like business as usual. I mean, all that does is it reinforces my commitment to a new business as usual, which is renewable energy. And, you know, there's something very warmongering about the present administration that is so convenient to billionaires. And I don't mean sort of that kind of wry billionaires for Bush kind of billionaires, but it's the real deal. You know, it's people who have built infrastructure that's worth billions of dollars, and they're making billions of dollars from it, whether it's nuclear plants or oil platforms. And they are reinforcing the strength and the control of these sectors. And so people like me say, okay, so what we need to do is just pull the rug out. And, you know, they're going to wake up one morning and say, wow, you know, 80% of the country has a solar panel. And we can't make our billions anymore because other people are making, frankly, millions, but not billions, on alternative energy that doesn't require war. So suddenly the war-making machinery that we also make billions of money from that requires massive infrastructure is also not necessary. You know, so I'm just trying to be a part of the movement that decentralizes and hopefully creates peace that way.
Well, certainly ExxonMobil, which made $10 billion in the last quarter, is profiting handsomely from everything that Bush is doing.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me.
Yeah.
You also have a song, Dar Williams, on your latest album, My Better Self, about enemies. Mm-hmm. And flags and things like that. And so that led me to wonder what your view of patriotism itself is.
I think it's going to happen. But it's, you know, the song Beautiful Enemy is, you know, actually points to those parts. You know, when that inevitable moment when you say, I can't, you know, I'm having a war over the hedges with my neighbors. How can I expect Israel and Palestine to get along? You know, it's one of those songs, and it looks at the flags and symbols and jingoisms of our sort of personal fiefdoms. And at the same time, I read this beautiful article by Amos Oz that I actually carried around with me, where he said, America is great. The United States is great. North America is really so incredible. Why would you want to flaunt that? Why would you want to use that so inappropriately? Why wouldn't you want to be the envy of your neighbors by being so good and so generous and so smart in how you use the power that you obviously have? And so I aspire to be part of that America. That's my patriotism.
I hear that, and it connects up with what Howard Zinn has been writing about, by, you know, why can't we be a superpower of goodness, you
right,
know,
right.
Of law and decency and justice instead of the superpower of violence. On the other hand, I'm kind of anti-patriotic myself. I don't believe in patriotism, or which is to say I just think patriotism is such a dangerous concept that it can be easily turned into its toxic cousin, nationalism. But I'm reminded right. of Annie DeFranco's song early in her career where she just, you know, screams out, I am a patriot, in mm-hmm. the most kind of anguished voice. And so I can see both sides of that. You have Annie DeFranco on this latest album, My Better Self. How did that work out?
It was great. I mean, it hopefully points to a certain collective unconscious that we were able to tap into, because she, with no direction from us, I mean, we sent the files off to her, that the music, she added her thing to it and sent them back and sent me a disc and really just nailed it, as they say. And almost, I felt like she was reading my mind, by doing something that was very in tune and yet very disembodied, you know, just really captured something that could have been very contradictory.
This is the song, the cover of the Pink Floyd song, Comfortably Numb. Why did you decide to choose that song?
I think, again, if we're looking at the present climate, it's so comfortable. I mean, we have such incredible, you know, we have the luxury of drinking such good wine and having such great information at our fingertips. I mean, I can look up anything on my computer, and I can call any friend at the drop of a hat on my cell phone, and I can have beautiful clothing and great food in a world where people are being tortured, and I have some responsibility for that, you know. And I would say that my patriotism is is basically contained within understanding what my sphere of influence is. As an American, I have this power. As a French person, I would have that power. You know, as a person from New York, I have this or that power. You know, so as a woman, I have different realms of influence. So so that's to say, there's an enormous amount of work to be done, and there's an enormous amount of comfort to feel right now. And from what I've been told, Roger Waters was experiencing some of that in Great Britain when he wrote Comfortably Numb, and I haven't confirmed that, corroborated that. But it's just a very unfortunate thing. And some of those things numb you out and keep you from acting. And so that whole layer, I think, was the final propulsion into actually wanting to record it, to really bring out the lyrical side of it.
You know, it's a real trick, though. Jerry Seinfeld was doing some stand-up after Katrina, and he has this bit about some yuppies, you know, wringing their hands about how terrible Katrina is, which is what, you know, we all felt. How could you not feel that way? And then they say, in the next sentence, where are we going out for dinner?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like I saw Jerry Seinfeld, you know, out there down in New Orleans handing out meals or anything, I mean, it's easy to sneer at. At the same time, he's pointing to something which is contradictory, that yet we need to be able to empathize with the people who are suffering there and not become paralyzed or callous.
No, and it's also important to try to figure out, you know, to feel good about the power you have. You know, my husband and I sent down money, of course, and I'm trying to do as much as I can with renewable energy and with supporting women's collectives and supporting women's collectives that are not just, you know, white women, women from other countries. And so, you know, I think that by supporting smaller democratic structures, you can affect change. So I didn't feel guilty saying, where are we going to go out for dinner? Because actually, I'm the kind of person who grabs so much crap on the go that actually sitting down and eating dinner is a very civilizing thing for me. And my husband's a real foodie. So that's you know, been a good thing for me politically, because then I can really have the gravitas to say, well, what can I really do?
I'm speaking with Dar Williams. I'm Matt Rothschild, the host of Progressive Radio. What power do you have as a folk singer?
To be honest, as long as I don't get completely overbearing, I have plenty. I mean, and I think about it in terms of, you know, it's like my sister's a teacher. She chose to teach in a place that where she knew she wouldn't be burnt out, which meant that it was a sort of a, you know, a nice middle class public school with a lot of kids in trouble on all ends of the class spectrum. And I think as a folk singer, I have a similar I have a similar thing where I don't want to burn out. So I do as many fundraisers as I can. That's obviously one place to go. And I try to make fundraisers into sort of a poetic opportunity to galvanize a community. So I try to make sure that I'm really saying something that's both accurate and a reminder to a community about why I think they're so cool and what they're doing is so cool. So, you know, there's a poetic opportunity that you have when you do a fundraiser. From my income, we, you know, my husband and I give a certain percentage away right off the top.
But
and then there's, I'm sorry, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but beyond, you know, doing the fundraisers and giving money charitably, what about intrinsically in the music and awakening people or changing their direction or something like that?
I could very easily say that's 100% of what I do. You know, I mean, aside from fundraisers and stuff, it's, I know how hard it is to be awake in my life. I think that I probably started to numb out in little extremities, as it were, you know, around the time of my first mortgage. It's just a constant reminder to wake up. And I think people want to sort of feel tingly with that hope that they can do something and a sense of interdependence and a sense of involvement that they get from being involved culturally to going out to hear live music and to hearing the poetry and certain lyrics. So, you know, certainly, I mean, I just write songs as they come to me. And now that, you know, I believe in God, I have an extra layer of sort of saying, I'll write about what I write about and assume that I'm being offered the opportunity to illuminate something important. But, you know, absolutely. No, I think, you know, poetry and live performance is, one could argue, is absolutely 100%. And actually, one friend said to me, when you've lost the poetry, you've lost everything. When you've lost that sense of all that kind of great transethical poetry that life is, yeah, you think that you're too important, then you become a sort of some kind of fascist. But there's a lot of concrete stuff to do, mm-hmm. too.
How do you balance live performance and recording? What is the difference for you? What you get out of one, not the other, for instance?
Well, live performance is, to be completely honest, is travel. So, you know, there's so much going on technically with recording that it's not, that you have to work really hard to make it a spiritual experience, and it's worth turning it into that. Whereas live performance, I mean, you just really get it. You know, you feel it from the audience. And the other day I was performing and I really felt the space, and I remembered what it's like to look down at that tiny little artist on the stage and to feel them filling up the room with what they're singing. And, you know, it's just, and I've been doing this for over a decade, but that was a very new recognition for me. So, you know, live performance is constantly invigorating and also gets me out in the world and seeing things like how beautiful the Midwest is and how exciting things are in Maine right now. There's like a lot of community action that's just totally inspiring. And so, you know, to get down to Pike's Market in Seattle and to see the Pacific Ocean, and, you know, it's good for the soul to get out and travel and then to meet the audiences in those cities.
I'm speaking with Dara Williams. It's Matt Rothschild from Progressive Radio. You have a very hopeful song on this album, My Better Self, called Echoes. And if you could just explain what you are trying to convey there, I think that would be great.
Okay, well, the most important thing is that I didn't write it. It was written by Jules Shear and Rob Hyman and Stuart Lerman, who are friends of mine. And I think Stuart brought it to me so that part of my psyche would be represented, because he knows me and he knows that I'm a giant optimist. And basically that the lyrics are, every time you love just a little, make one step closer, solving the riddle, it echoes all over the world. And the lyrics are all sort of like that, very almost child rhyme-ish and yet profound. And so that's been, it's been nice to sing it, because it reminds me of something that I could not put into words. I mean, I've simplified a lot, but I don't think I could ever sort of be so open-heartedly optimistic in a song. I always feel like I've got to sort of gunk it up with more complexity. but, you know, God bless them for you know, singing out for the open heart.
Well, and you're right out there, too, calling yourself a giant optimist.
Yeah.
Why that?
Well, you know, somebody asked Athel Fugard if he was an optimist, and he said yes, because I get out of bed in the morning. I mean, I had a really bad depression when I was 21. I mean, thank goodness, you know, people, friends of mine, insisted that I go to therapy because they saw the crash coming. And so I am one of those sort of those lesser types, those sensitive types, those people who wouldn't have made it on their own if other people hadn't helped them, who, you know, of a straightforward capitalist society would have sort of cut off and you know, let die, you know. And so I was saved by my friends, and I was saved by my family and by people who cared about me, and by modern psychotherapy that cared about women. And so, you know, that was profound. And then, of course, coming out of that and saying, I don't want to go back to feeling depressed. What can I be optimistic about in terms of the course of the planet? And discovering, you know, that there was no end to the optimism I felt. You know, those were seminal experiences. And now, you know, almost 20 years later, I'm still right there.
That's going to have to be it. Dara Williams, thanks so much for being my guest on Progressive Radio.
Thanks.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.